The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
So welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Alex Gers, and I'm the Associate Vice President of External Affairs here at the Free Library. Our mission is to advance literacy, guide learning, and inspire curiosity. Author events such as tonight advance these goals by bringing great writers to Philadelphia. Please visit freelibrary.org/support to make a gift that will help the library continue to produce such transformative programming. And while you're online, don't forget to sign up for a library card. It's now my pleasure to introduce tonight's author, Beck Dory Stein. A White House stenographer from 2012 to 2017, Dory Stein was balancing a handful of part-time jobs when she answered an unlikely Craigslist post that ultimately landed her in the Oval Office. As one of former President Obama's elite support staff members, she forged close relationships with the other young professionals who accompanied him on journeys across the globe. In her memoir, From the Corner of the Oval, she pulls back the curtain on the Obama White House and details the entanglements that turned the political into the personal. A colleague handed me an advanced copy of From the Corner to the Oval several months ago, and I tore through it in just a couple of days and have been on a one-woman quest ever since to recommend it to everyone I know, including all of you here tonight. Dory Stein's writing is wildly hilarious, yet deeply poignant. And while the book details her time keeping track of someone else's words, it's abundantly clear that she has a voice that's all her own, and I'm so delighted she's here to share it with us tonight. What's more, she'll be appearing in conversation with the incomparable Tamla Edwards, anchor of 6ABC's Action News Morning Edition, and a wonderful friend to the Free Library. We're so pleased to have them both here with us this evening, so please join me in welcoming Beck Dory Stein and Tamla Edwards to the Free Library.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. And first I have to ask, where's Beck's mother? Can you please?
I heard the bracelet.
Okay, so just the story she's told me in the back room, I want you to be my mother too.
I said you were thorough.
So she says you're very, very thorough. All right, so Beck, it is great to be here with you. I really enjoyed the book.
Thank you.
Let's start with the crazy. So for many people here, kind of know a little bit about your story, but explain to them the crazy, circuitous way you end up in the picture frame of I don't have a job to I work at the White House.
So it's 2012, and I have 5 part-time jobs. They're all extremely glamorous. They include cocktail waitressing and folding tank tops at Lululemon and tutoring a bunch of kids. They're all fun, but none of them are really going anywhere quickly. Although I do think I might have a lead at Lululemon. I think if I stick with it, I might be a manager in like a year. And so I'm working these 5 part-time jobs. I apply to a job on Craigslist to be a stenographer in a law firm. And lo and behold, it turns out to be something else, which I don't know at the time. And so I actually blow off the interview because I was trying to be a manager at Lululemon and my shift ran late. So I was showing I would, you know, fold the extra stack of wide tank tops. And then I emailed this person. I was like, I'm so sorry. This isn't going to work out. I'm just too busy. And she wrote back, and I was like, I'm not opening this email. She's going to say I'm a terrible person. And instead she said, this is actually a job at the White House, and you'd be traveling with the president. And my initial response was, president of what?
Now, as I was telling you backstage, I covered the White House. I did various things. The stenos are known for being in the background, really quiet. You buck it right away. You know, you've got people yelling at you, you can't do this, you can't do that. Why do you think you did that rather than, okay, this is the way they do it, and so that's the way I'll do it?
I tried. I tried to fit in, and it just wasn't going my way. But I did. I made an effort, and sort of part of it was just like, well, this is what I'm working with. So I have this old duffel bag, so of course I'll use that to go on Air Force One. Who cares if it's 20 years old?
And as you get going, you're explain the process, because you would write things. In fact, it's a recurring theme in the book that if somebody leaves, you give them a page or a paragraph that you've written about them. Was this just your diary that turned into something more? Like, how did you make yourself actually find the time to do it?
So as a stenographer, your job is to record public and private statements and then transcribe them, type them up into a transcript. And so when you're working in the moment, it's a lot of work. But then when you're not working, you really get to hang your hat at the end of the day. And because I'd been a teacher before, it was the complete opposite. I always had homework, and all of a sudden I was like, oh, I'm done. And because I was seeing all of these crazy things, I actually did have the time to write. I'd wake up early and write, and I'd stay up late and write. And so the first time that I did this was David Plouffe, who was a senior advisor, passed me on a run. And he's much older than I am. And it was embarrassing, but also incredible, because I was like, he's so busy, and yet he's also so fast. And I can't even be mad, because I'm just so impressed with him right now. And so I went back to my room that day and wrote up this whole thing about, oh my gosh, and here's this senior advisor passing me in Las Vegas somewhere. And I remember sitting in my parents' house right before Thanksgiving, and my sister walked in, and she was like, why are you working on that? No one's ever going to read that. Which is true. And then 2 months later, he left, and I was like, oh, I've got to give this to him. And it was just sort of this gut response of, hey, he's like, what, 50? Like, of course he's going to want to hear about how fast he is, which he did.
And it's a recurring theme as you give these pages. People ping you back pretty quickly, and they tell you, you're a good writer. Did that push you in a different way, having the president, David Plouffe, other people tell you, you're a good writer?
I mean, it didn't hurt. It's pretty nice. It was this moment where I would hand it off to them, and I'd be like, okay, I'm so glad it's out of my hands. And then I'd walk back to my office, and I would all of a sudden really need to throw up, because I was like, what did I just do? That was the most insane thing I could have done. And then the key to being successful, I think, in part, these people always say, is that they always respond to emails really quickly, which is true. They respond so quickly, and it was just this instant gratification and satisfaction and also encouragement that kept me pushing along.
Now I know why I'm not successful. It takes me forever to respond.
Yeah,
to
the incomparable Tam is not successful.
So I never sent my writing on a whim to David Remnick. Explain what got you to do that. Like, I would be like, I'm not going to give him a pin, let alone my writing.
Yeah, that's called sweet ignorance, not understanding the hierarchy in its fullest.
Okay.
Yeah.
It worked.
I was so outside the universe that I was like, why not?
And it did indeed work. Yeah. As I read the book, one of the things that was interesting to me, that it was sort of the best of times and the worst of times. You're there at Stonehenge or Petra or Cuba when these incredible things are going on. But it's also misery. You're exhausted. You fall asleep under the table at Thanksgiving. You're tired all the time. You have to force yourself to run. How do you explain it to people? Do you remember the good or the bad? What was it like to have that mix of it's great and it's awful all at the same time?
It breeds a really sweet bipolarism that, you know, you can't refute. And yet at the same time, it's the highs, it's the highest of highs and the lowest in low of lows, and you just have to sort of embrace both.
And you also write about the women that you encounter. On one hand, you have a great group of girlfriends that you meet. A videographer, a photographer, other
They're
people.
Here.
Hello to wherever they hope and show up.
Celebrities, Pat the Hod's here.
And there's some really cool, powerful women. The way you write about Susan Rice or others, they're the way you would want them to be. But then there's the Rattler and the Vagiants, who are not very nice. And yet you would look at some of the boys in this system who take you under their wing and get to be, you expect them to be jerks, not the women. What was going on there?
Well, have you ever experienced a Rattler?
I think every woman in this audience has experienced, so a lot of people here work for a Rattler.
Right, and yeah. So that was why I wanted to write about the Rattler. It was because I sort of thought, oh my gosh, this is crazy, and then it's like, it's not crazy at all. It's this common roadblock where sometimes women are not great to other women. And at first, when I was at the White House, that's all I could see. All I could see was this Rattler who seemed to almost be going out of her way to make me feel awful. And then the longer I was there, it was like, oh, wait, no, if I just kind of shove her to the side, there are all of these incredible women who are going out of their way to encourage me and to lift me up. And so that's what I had to start really focusing on. And then she kind of just seemed sort of sad.
No.
And now she's the Rattler.
And now she's like, I'm the Rattler, yeah. And she's got a two-book yeah. deal and a movie.
Yeah.
Hopefully you'll bump into the Rattler before this is all over.
Yeah.
Something
we'll
else.
We'll hear her coming.
Something else that you capture well, I didn't enjoy living in Washington, and you got the kiss up, kick down, this is not fun aspect of the town, where you're on the inside, but you always feel like you're on the outside. And it feels like that never goes away. Like, it's work all the time.
It's work all the time. And I still remember being in Trader Joe's, and we had just gotten back from this 10-day Asia swing, and I was exhausted, and I'm grocery shopping. It's 2 in the afternoon. I have no idea what's going on, because it's sort of like 2 a.m. my time. And the bagger at Trader Joe's is just like, so what do you do? And I was like, really? What? Right now? Really? We're doing that? And I was like, well, and then I realized, normally I would say I was a teacher, which is what I was before, and then it's like, you know, 2 p.m. on a Wednesday during the school year. That wouldn't look very good. So I'm like, well, I work at the White House. And they were like, well, do you actually work at the White House? Or do you work in the EEOB? And I was like, oh, are you a bagger, or, you know, are you running the cash register here?
I just remember at parties, nobody could talk to you without saying first, well, this is off the record.
Yeah.
And you're like, what you're about to say is really not that interesting. Yeah. It doesn't need to be off the record.
Yeah. Yeah. We're not going anywhere
no.
here.
There's a Bridget Jones-like subplot throughout the book. There's Jason, who's a louse. There's Sam, the boyfriend, who's up and down. And I wonder what it was like. You really put it out there. You're really honest about the good parts, the bad parts, including about yourself. And what was it like to be that honest and look at it on the page when your mother is editing the pages?
You want to get up here? There was no other way for me to write it. This is how it came out. This was how I needed to write it. And luckily I have a really great editor who could kind of peel me off the ceiling when she needed to. But for the most part, it was like, this is what happened. I think this is more common than we realize. I think more people have a Jason. A Jason almost seems
everybody.
Unavoidable. Everybody has a Jason. Everybody has a Rattler. Everybody has a Jason. And so when I was experiencing these things, I felt so isolated and so alone. And so by writing it, I felt like I was bridging it to, as like, we can talk about this. This is sort of what your 20s is all about. It's navigating these roadblocks.
Because a third of the way in, you know, it's just like, Beck, I don't think this is going to work out. And then two-thirds in, I was literally yelling at you in the book, like, Beck, we got to meet some other people.
I sat down next to a woman, and she was like, you know, I like you, but I kind of hate you, because you just should have learned much earlier. And I was like, I know. And she was like, but I had the same thing happen in my 20s.
And you talk about what you learned from it as you look back, especially the latter half, when it's just clear Jason's not going to get it together. He's with
what
this one
mean?
And he's that one. If you are still talking with him, we're ending this interview and going backstage. But, you know, a lot of life is looking back and processing it. How do you look back on it and process it now? Do you cut yourself a break? What do you think?
Writing it was really therapeutic. I got to kind of see how these things might have happened and kind of forgive myself. When it was going on, I was so mad at myself, and Hope Hall had to constantly be like, you got to be nicer to my friend Beck, you know, you're really being mean to her right now. And I was like, that's because Beck sucks right now. What is her problem? So it was actually really nice to go back and be like, okay, this is what happened, and we've moved on from it, and I've learned so much. I'm a little less, you know, self-righteous now. I'm a little more generous with people who find themselves in similar situations.
Has Jason reached out to you about the book?
No.
And if you bumped into him, do you think it would be friendly? Do you think you'd enjoy the conversation?
Oh, of course it would be so friendly. He's like super supportive of all of this. No, come on, Tam. Come on.
You know what? Look, he might just say, this is who I want to play me in the movie.
Maybe. Stay tuned.
So I got to ask you some Big Sky questions, because you were there, and what a change, Obama to Trump. And you write a little bit about it, and you write about it as being a sports person. You know, folks were celebrating too early. But as you look back, you know, I'm sure people ask you all the time, as Hillary's book said, what happened? How do you answer the question?
I'm just the stenographer.
Hey, you were there. You have to have some perspective. You were in the halls. You were on the road. And you know, staffers have to, you go through something on a different level, and you write about being there when Obama gave the speech in the Rose Garden, and you're trying to wrap your brain about it, around it, and make sense of it. And I just sort of wondered what that was like for you, and kind of what answers you came up with as the rest of us continue to try to come up with answers.
Well, so I went home to vote, and so I was actually at 30th Street Station the morning after, and I remember looking around being like, who did this? Like, who voted? And it sort of felt like Harry Potter, where it was like, oh my God, like, who are the Death Eaters here? Like, how did this happen? And so being back at the White House the day after and the month after wasn't unlike being in Philadelphia, where people were kind of walking around looking like the love of their life had just broken up with them. It was a devastating time.
So we want some good gossip at this point. You've been around both men. I want to hear, what is it like? How did they strike you? How are they different? How are they alike?
So the first time President Obama walked into the Roosevelt Room, my hands were immediately shaking, and I was sweating, and I kind of blacked out, and then remembered I had a job to do. But the whole time I was shaking, and I was like, this is what it's like to be around the president. And then when I covered a similar roundtable in the Roosevelt Room with Trump, I realized it's not what it's like to be around the president, it was what it was like to be around President Obama. Because Trump walked in the room, I was like, this guy? So that, I mean, it's not the same. It's not the power of the presidency, for better or for worse. It was much more, President Obama commanded that attention, and he demanded that respect because he respected every single person in the room. Every time a little kid walked into the room, he was down on their level. And you see that in photographs all the time. And that's the difference, is Trump is constantly trying to compensate for something. Competency, at the least.
You also write about the difference in staff. Like, there are some, you know, I saw some things you said in interviews, and also just what it's like to be in the van and not respond. That would be hard for me.
Yeah. Well, so the first time, I flew to Mar-a-Lago once, and I get into the way back of the van, like I had always done. And then I see the driver tilt his rear view mirror back, and he's like, hey, Beck. And I'm like, oh, God. Because everyone was new, so the fact that he knew my name already, like right away, is this sign that like I'm a regular. And I'm like, oh, hi. And he was like, I'm surprised you stuck around. And I'm like, shh. Because now all of a sudden his staffers are piling in, and he was like, I really thought you were an Obama girl. This is shocking to see you here. And I'm like, indeed. Yeah. And that was kind of, so no one talked on that van ride. They all just kept looking back. I think they were all BlackBerry, or, you know, right, messaging about the steno in the back.
So you pretty quickly make friends in the Obama White House. Did you find that you could bond with any of the Trump staffers, or it was like going to Mars?
So I went to Mar-a-Lago, and this girl asked me what my running path had been. And it was very hard to not see. So we didn't stay at Mar-a-Lago. We stayed at this horrible hotel. And you have to run on a highway, and then you go over a bridge, and on either side of the bridge, there's signs that say, alligators, like, not our problem if you get eaten. And then, like, these cars are coming at, like, 90 miles an hour, and I was like, this actually just feels like life right now, whereas, like, I either get run over or eaten by an alligator. And so this woman, who I was like, she seems okay, but she had been like a Ted Cruz supporter the whole time, and she kept apologizing. She was like, I just really wanted Ted Cruz to win. And I was like, that doesn't make things any better right now. And so when she asked for my running route, I was like, straight to the alligators. Just go. So no, I had a hard time.
It's a very sweet scene when you vote and the election returns come in. Your dad tucks you in bed almost as if you're a little girl, and he's crying. And I find that anybody who has anything to do with politics, the question they get over and over again, so I will pose it to you, is people say, are we going to be okay? And obviously nobody has any other answer than the answer they have. But I wonder what your answer was to that question.
My answer was, okay, I just spent 5 years getting to record and transcribe everything President Obama said, and he said we would be okay. So instead of like my what would Jesus do, I'm just like, what would Barack Obama do? He would say we would be okay. He would just say we need to be really active citizens.
So you're going to go to Italy and look really great in your leisure wear, like the president has.
We're just going to take a break, reset, and come back stronger than ever.
So you turn the book in. It's got a movie attached. And you've got a second book, Do you have any idea what you want to write about?
It's going to be a book of haikus. Drool. It's going to be awesome. My publisher's in the front row. She's thrilled.
It's going to be awesome.
Yeah. It's also going to just be about cats.
I doubt that. In the beginning, when you're looking for jobs, your boyfriend, I think, sends you this email, and it's a Steve Jobs quote. You don't connect the dots looking forward. You can only connect them looking backwards. So you have to trust that the dots will somehow connect in your future. I loved that quote in the book. And how do you look on that quote now?
I think I quoted that again today or yesterday. It has gotten me through a lot of crazy, upsetting times and also the best of times where it's just like, all right, you just sometimes have to do faith and you have to put in the work and you have to just trust that if you're doing the best you can possibly do, then it's going to work out, even if it seems like nothing is working out.
And I asked you about Jason. I didn't ask you about Sam. How's Sam?
Sam's great.
And does Sam know about the book? Do you still talk to
Sam?
Yes,
Sam is supportive. Sam's okay. Good.
I was always team Sam.
Yeah.
So it's now at the point where people can ask questions if they would like to. And I'm told that this is a crowd who might have some interesting questions, so I'm looking forward to them.
Hi, I'm David. I just wondered, do stenographers have a job in the Trump White House?
They do. It's much easier because he uses much smaller words. So, yeah.
Hi, I'm David Hyman. And
David Hyman's in the house.
My question is, do you have more or less faith in our government having gone through this experience?
Faith?
Yes.
Oh, man. Again, I want to pull the stenographer card. I don't know. It's an interesting time. I don't have an answer to that. Sorry. We're all going to have to work on that one together.
Would you find yourself getting into the moment when he would give speeches, Obama, or you were so focused on, I've got to get this recorded or I've got to get transcribed, or would you find that you stopped and were swept away by the moment?
In the beginning, I was swept away, and then I sort of went through this jaded process, like where I was just sort of like, all right, I've heard this, he's fine. And then towards the end, when I knew that it was coming to an end and I could really appreciate him all over again, I would really just sit and listen and was like, oh God, we are gonna miss this guy.
And in the book, again, you write about that feeling that everybody was being too assumptive. How far in, how early did you have that feeling?
There was one time we went to Florida for like the third day in a row and I was like, didn't we just do this? So there was a little bit of that. But again, just the stenographer.
The stenographer.
I just noticed we were going to Florida.
You're like, I like Florida, but maybe we should go to Michigan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was so great when Michelle Wolf was like, it's a direct flight. It's easy.
Anybody else with questions?
Hi. I wanted to ask if you have an opinion about why all of the Republicans are just standing by and letting this happen. I mean, these are educated people. They've worked with the Obama administration on a number of...
So you want me to speak on behalf of Republicans?
No, I'm just wondering if you have an opinion about why the country seems to have taken such a dramatic turn and you know, with the, you know, sort of the backing of Republicans that...
Well, this is why I didn't really succeed or thrive in Washington, because I'm not really one to play nice with the other team. And I think Republicans right now are kowtowing to the guy in power, and he's in power, and so they're playing along with him. And that's why I can't wait for Mitch McConnell to just crawl back into his little turtle shell and disappear.
I will say it was shocking in the book because the way you describe D.C. when you first get there, it's like everybody works for Obama for America.
Yeah.
And it just has to be like you went through the looking glass now when you go back. And
it's I haven't gone back. I've stayed away. I'm going back on Friday the 13th. What could go wrong? That's going to be great.
Right there in the back.
So as a young woman in Washington and politics now, what do you feel like your role is carrying out what you learned during the Obama legacy and moving forward and helping to get more women involved in politics and have jobs where they are in the office and have a seat at the table?
Can you repeat that? My sister distracted me. I think you're one of her running friends. place.
Yes, she told us no one was coming. Yeah,
cool. No, I was trying to figure out what her emotions were in the front row. I thought she was having a seizure. Go ahead. Sorry, can you just repeat that?
What do you feel like your role is as a young woman who worked in the White House and carrying out the Obama legacy and getting more women involved in politics and having a seat at the table?
It's a great question. So I always wanted to be a writer, and I was never great with politics. I'm much more politically active now, and I think it's all of our responsibilities to be engaged citizens. That being said, I'm really excited that I get to write full time. And I think what I took away from being in the White House and being surrounded by all of those political people was that I was truly inspired by how many people were working so hard every day to do right by the American people. And what I saw from high-powered people who I never expected to share air with was they were really kind and very respectful to everyone in the room. And they, especially the women who did well for themselves, were not afraid to speak up. And they were also great at supporting each other and kind of saying, oh, yeah, I support that. Or at a table, they would kind of bounce off that idea and be like, and as Caroline was saying. And so just those little things actually really add up.
Right there.
In regard to both administrations, were you under any sort of contractual confidentiality obligation, and was your manuscript reviewed?
Oh, it'd be super awkward right now if I'd broken any rules. No, I followed all the rules. I was not under any contract, and I shared it with the Obama Council, and I would have shared it with the Trump Council, except I'm not sure they know who they are right now. There's a lot of fluidity in that department, so we sort of just surpassed that.
Right there.
Hi. If I worked at the White House for 5 years, I'd probably want to write a book about it, too, and many have.
Kathy's coming for me.
But most have been very politically slanted, and yours is very personal, with kind of the background of the White House as the setting. How did you decide to take that slant to the story?
It was the only slant I could do. So initially I had a bunch of essays, and then I got some really good advice that I had this bizarre story where I'd gotten the job on Craigslist, and so I should sort of follow that through. And if I was going to write about myself, I was going to write about my whole self, and this is what we got. This is what we landed with. It happened pretty naturally. The book kind of wrote itself.
Do you find yourself reading the other books, like the Ben Rhodes book or any of the other ones? And what is it like to see them give more of what they were thinking at the time?
I haven't read Ben Rhodes' book yet, but I'm looking forward to it. He was sort of a mentor early on. He took me aside and he let me know I was trying to type, and he was like, you know, I was a stenographer once. And so he was really nice. And he one time gaggled without me, which didn't go so well. And I flipped out on him because I was just like, you can't gaggle without me. I'm the stenographer. Because it was after our 10-day trip and 2 glasses of wine. And he was really great and actually sat with me and helped me edit the transcript. So I'm looking forward to that. He also thought I should be a TV show host when I told him I wanted to be a writer. So I'm excited
There's
to send him
time.
My book.
Yeah. But have you read any of the other books, the Obama various books that have come out?
Yeah, most of them. And David Litt was really generous with his time. He was the one who helped me figure out how do you write a book. I sat down with him, and he was like, first you need an agent, because I had no idea. I just had a bunch of documents that were not saved on my laptop.
For all of us who haven't worked in the White House, are there any one or two or three things that you would say people would be surprised to learn about the workings of that office, of that place, that an outsider might not know about?
It's hard to get a good cup of coffee, and so when you do want something a little stronger, you have to exit, which is no small feat. You have to go through 2 things of security, and then when you come back, you have to go through 3 things of security, so then you're sitting at your desk being like, how much do I need that cup of coffee right now? Aside from that, I'd like to think, especially during the Obama administration, that they worked really hard. They worked even harder than we thought. I got to be in the room with these people where basically personal lives got thrown to the wayside because they were like, I'm here every day working for President Obama, who's trying to make everyone's lives a little bit better. And so to see that work ethic up close was jaw-dropping.
My idea of the working of the White House comes from watching West Wing.
Ooh. It always works out on the West Wing.
Well, not the, just the constant many balls in the air is the way that program was written. Does that bear any resemblance to the West Wing?
So, as the stenographer, I was normally not in those, I was not in a lot of the closed-door meetings. That being said, I would see President Obama's schedule every day, and it was wild to see him go from the Situation Room back to the Oval Office to do departure photos with active duty military, and then to go from that to meeting with a little kid from the Make-A-Wish Foundation. And he could flip and kind of just figure out where he was and get into the zone for that moment in a way that I'd never seen before. So for me, no, I had it relatively easy. But for President Obama, I think he was, yes, it was always kind of juggling a million balls in the air and also at the same time figuring out, okay, here's this little boy in front of me, so I'm going to get down and just talk to him for the next 10 minutes, and we'll go from there.
I'm sure people ask you all the time, what is he like? What stays with you?
So President Obama spoke at my college graduation, and I got to shake his hand, and I didn't wash my hand for 3 days, because that's what you do. And then I thought that was sort of going to be it. And then when I ended up at the White House, after I'd gotten this crazy Craigslist job, I'm walking there the first day, and I stopped dead in my tracks. I'm like, oh, no, what if he's not great? Like, he could totally not be great. He could just be one more kind of greasy politician who speaks well, and it's fine. And within 2 minutes of being in the same room with him, I'm like, oh, he's exactly who we thought he was, except he's actually a little better because he's a little funnier and he's sharper and he loves to catch you on your heels. So every time that you're like, he's the president, he's not going to acknowledge me, he'll be like, hey. He's like that cool friend's dad that you're like, oh, God, he got me again.
One of the expressions that's always attached to the experience in the White House is the bubble effect. And you described your feeling, which I guess was a lot of our feelings the day after the election, of just being shocked. Was that the bubble effect at work? And could you just like give us a sense of the separation from our country, I guess, or the citizens that happens as a result of working in the White House? Like, what is that effect like, I guess, is what I'm curious about.
The day after, I felt like we were all just citizens. We were all extremely upset with what does this mean, what are the ramifications of this election. So a lot of times it was the bubble effect where we were just sort of traveling in our own world and we were all drinking the Kool-Aid heavily. But the day after the election was actually when we were all just sort of Americans being like, wow, this is this what's going to happen to our climate and what's going to happen to our kids and what's going to happen to our schools.
So what kind of jobs were you looking for on Craigslist when you found this job listing? And how did the other stenographers find this job? Did they also find the ad on Craigslist?
I'm so glad you asked, Hoka Lindsay, another running friend of my sister's, because I'm actually here today to tell you to drop out of school and just apply to jobs on Craigslist. I think I was looking for, I don't know, it was probably writing. Don't do that. Just, no. The Craigslist ad, normally what happens is, it's this totally legitimate company. They've been doing the stenographers at the White House, placing them there since Reagan. And so normally what happens is they recruit you, you spend at least a year working in their offices, and then if you're great, then you get promoted to the State Department, and then eventually you get to work at the White House. So then, because I had taught at Sidwell Friends, which is this exclusive independent school, and the Obama girls had gone there, and I was an English major, so I had some nice background padding. And I think they were also just sort of desperate. And so I just got skyrocketed to the top, which was super awkward during the first Christmas party when I went to this contracting company and I met this super weird dude. And he was like, that was supposed to be my job. It's the one and only Christmas party I went to.
How did the other stenos feel about you having had this book?
Like, all here.
The other people,
none of them are here.
Yeah, because they want to shut down your exuberance, it seems.
Yeah, So I was a very good high school English teacher, if I do say so myself. I think I was a pretty horrible... Oh! We have some petty students here. That's so nice. So I got to teach at a boarding school for 2 years after graduation, and I think I was decent. Carolyn Horner just gave me a woot, so I'll take it. And from there, being a stenographer is sort of the exact opposite, where when you're a teacher, you are bringing the energy, especially for first period on a Monday at 7:35 in the morning. And that's great, but when you're a stenographer, it's like, you just shut up in the corner, and it's great. And that's your role. And the other stenographers were self-selecting people who were dedicated, and they were really good at not talking out of turn, and that was just not who I was, because I identify more as a teacher than as a stenographer. So it was a learning curve, and I don't think I ever quite learned.
Did you know their reactions when they found out about the book?
Oh, yeah, I got some. I think Caroline had to report some cyberbullying on Facebook. It was wild. It was a wild time. Best of times, worst of times.
All right, maybe they don't buy tickets to the movie.
They don't, no, I don't think so. But I will say, Peggy, my boss, who had been there since Reagan, was extremely supportive. And so that was really nice to have the head honcho giving me her blessing. And she had always known. They had all known I had wanted to write. I think it was just one of those funny things where I was like, oh no, she did the damn thing after all. We're now down a stenographer.
So earlier you said that you became more politically active after working for the Obama administration. So knowing that, or seeing that you know what a successful White House looks like, what are some suggestions that you have for us to become more politically active now?
So that's a great question, and there are people who can answer this better than I can, but I will say just knowing who's in office and how they're voting is really important, especially at a local level, and kind of branching out from there, but just knowing who's representing you right now and who's voting on your behalf right now is extremely important. And if you don't like the way they're voting, you can change that. And you can recruit 1 or 2 or 10 friends to go with you, especially during the midterms, to change that. We can do it. Oh, hello.
Hi. So very, very proud of you.
Godmother's in the house.
And so nice to be here. So can you tell us anything about a movie? Is there anything in the works for this?
There's something in the works. Yeah, so Anonymous Production, which did Spotlight, which is great. And yeah, guys. And Universal Studios paired up before, or I think the same day the book sold, they did the movie rights as well. So they have that, and they're working on it. And they, you know, I kind of, for better or for worse, I gave them my baby, and so they're doing their own thing. Sorry.
Emma Stone, Jennifer Lawrence, if you had to choose, which one would you?
I can't choose.
Maybe you want both of them, maybe?
I just love them both. I mean, it's mostly just like, how do I get to hang out with them?
I think you're on a path that you're going to make that happen one way or the other. Okay, we're down to the last question.
This seems like it should have been the first question, but we live in such a high-tech world. I thought stenographers... I mean, did you
and me both. I know where this is going.
Did you take shorthand, I mean, or... I thought they would just record everything and somebody would type it later or something.
That's what we did. I totally gamed the system. I mean, it's a nice job to have. I did not know that stenographers existed in the 21st century. There is voice recognition technology that's not apparently quite there yet, or that's what the stenographers keep telling the government. I'm not quite sure. I left. But because of that, my job was not, you know, you see these court stenographers and they're so skilled and they can type in real time and they have little typewriters and they're just amazing. And I can't do any of that. I never could. And so instead it was like, we would go in and the White House stenographers were trained more to be discreet. And so you would enter a room, you'd place down your recorder in the Oval Office if President Obama had an interview, and then you'd go and find your chair on the opposite side of the room and just sit there and listen. Okay, you know, it was such a privilege to get to sit in and listen, and that was funny because it was my job, and then I just had to have a heart attack halfway through when I was like, oh my God, what if the batteries run out? Did I even press record? Did I do my job at all? And then the interview would end, I'd collect my recorders, And then we would go back up to our office and we'd sort of round robin type up the whole thing. So if it was an hour long interview, we'd divide it among the five of us. And so it was very easy, which was why it was horrible when my volunteer motorcade driver was like, "You're the stenographer," because I had my assigned seat in the Press One van. And I was like, "I am." And he was like, "Well, I'm in stenography school. I hope to have your job one day." And I was like, "Oh my God, you're so overqualified." So no, I'm with you. But they haven't gotten onto us yet.
I think at the end of the book, you know that the Trump people don't seem to regard the stenography aspect with importance. We don't really need that. How did that make you feel? I mean, what a break with tradition.
Well, everything about the Trump administration was sort of a break with tradition. So, yeah, I mean, when I was leaving, I went into room one, which is known for being the administrative office. It always had been. And I go in there, and you have to, it's not unlike your last day of college or high school, where you have to kind of get a bunch of signatures, where it's like, here's my laptop. I didn't break it. Can I have your signature? And so I went to room one to get their signature, and I open the door, and this woman slams the door on me. And so I'm like, "Hey, I'm just here because I'm trying to get out of here. Can I just get a signature?" And she opens the door, and all these people are on the ground with all these piles of papers. And I'm like, "This smells totally legal. Everything's fine." Yeah, and they just signed it. I don't even know who signed it. So no, there were, I mean, the break was across the board. Them treating stenographers with disrespect was not my biggest qualm. It was more like, "Oh, you treat women with disrespect. Oh, you treat basically everyone who's not a 60-year-old Mike Pence with disrespect." Actually, Mike Pence kind of got disrespected along the way, too. So,
when was the moment you knew, "I got to go"? Because you stay on while other people leave.
So I, as soon as Trump won, that was my incentive to start taking my writing seriously. It was sort of like, well, if I don't take myself seriously now, when will I? And so as soon as he won, that's when I was like, "I got to get out of here." And I had some really great mentors and friends who had been encouraging me to take my writing seriously. I applied to 7 MFA programs, and I got rejected from all 7. Yeah. It's okay. It worked out. And and so then by the time that I was there for 2 months, I'd stuck around because I was just trying to make rent. And when I left, it was because my delightful agent, best friend Becky, called me and she was like, "You can stop typing that Sean Spicer briefing right now. Like, you're good. We're good. You're done."
Do you miss it at all, the White House, Washington?
I miss the Obama White House, but that was gone. And so talk about staying too long at the party. Like, God, everyone, I mean, when Cinderella left, it was just sort of like, that's a bummer. When I left, it was like, oh my God, they're all mutants. We gotta get out of here.
All right, on that note, we want to thank Beck for being here. You'll be able to buy her book and have her sign it outside. Well done.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.